Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome everybody to Jawanza for Life. Got another special one lined up for you. You're going to be so glad that you tuned in today. Oh boy, this is one of those shows where you talk to people. It's always an honor to speak with somebody that does not need an introduction. But in case you were just born yesterday, or you just, you know, came to the planet from Mars or something, and you don't know who my guest is, you saw the advertisement, but if you just don't recognize the name, like I said, if you were just born yesterday and you don't recognize the name Sarah Dash, then let me tell you a little bit about her. She is going to be my special guest today, by the way. That's Queen Sarah Dash. She has sung with some of the greatest names in pop, rock, and R&B. Try the Rolling Stones, Alice Cooper, the Marshall Tucker Band, Laura Nyro, the OJs, that's right, the OJs, Wilson Pickett, and Bo Diddley, among others. She's appeared on shows with hundreds of renowned recording artists, from Keith Richards to Stevie Wonder. She's, of course, a founding member of Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, morphing into LaBelle in the 1970s, and they reunited in 2008 for a new album and a tour, and she has her own hits with the dance music classics, Center Man, Low Down Dirty Rhythm. In more recent times, a 2007 appearance in San Francisco's Teatro Zenzani theatrical production drew rave reviews. Even a cursory glance at Sarah Dash's career accomplishments reveals a woman steeped in music who's lived through ever-changing trends and times in the world of entertainment and remains as vital and vibrant as ever. She's quite simply a soul survivor. And it is without further ado that I step aside and welcome back to Jawanza for Life, Queen Sarah Dash. And that was the song that you heard, the intro, that was Hold On. And again, I'm just so excited. I'm tongue-tied. So let me move out of the way and get to my guest. Queen Sarah, welcome back to Jawanza for Life. How are you, my sister?
I am fine. And I love the title, Queen Sarah. That is beautiful. I'm doing really good, Jawanza. I am at a very special place and time right now in my life and career as well. And it feels really good to be sitting here and to still, you know, waking up with two gifts, both my eyes, you know, my tongue, my teeth, no bodily apparatus to hold me up. And, I just thank God for the wonderful blessings that He has placed on me and my family these past few months and years that I decided to come back to New Jersey to be around my family. My music career, having listened to you talk about all those people and wonderful artists that I've had great opportunities to work with and to learn from and to just be backstage and having such fun and, you know, learning from each other down through the years, that's I find that a very wealthy experience. And I'm humbled, greatly humbled by those times in my life. I take nothing for granted, and I'm just really appreciative for all of those musicians and artists who, you know, check on me from time to time, and you know, it's very, very, very motivating.
You know, Queen Sarah, as every time that I speak with you, it is a spiritual affair. Even just now, you started off, you know, even just thanking God for the gifts of sight, you know, the gifts of being able to speak, being able to, you know, move without an apparatus. And, you know, even as I was sharing this show with listeners today and letting them know who was coming on, one of the listeners who's actually on right now, listening online, was sharing, Queen Renee was saying that when she listened in last year, that she was blessed, you know, tremendously by the show. And so she's tuned back in. She's on the board today. And so I just want to say hello to Queen Renee. Hello, my mother-in-law is on board. Hey, Ma, how you doing? And to everybody
yeah.
else. Yep. So
oh,
if you have
beautiful.
A question.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So again, you always give God the glory. You always give God the praise for just being here. And I think that a lot of times we take that for granted. We get so caught up oftentimes in what's going on in our life. We can get distracted from the big picture. And if we were able to just remember that, just like you said, being able to open our eyes, being able to speak without help, being able to move without help, that is truly, truly a blessing. And I thank
yes.
you for bringing that to our remembrance today.
Yes, it truly is. You know, there was a time when I think I've shared this with your audience before that there was a time when I couldn't walk without assistance. And that was 4.5 years of my life of standing up, never knowing when I was going to fall down and, you know, couldn't take 2 steps. You know, my leg was, my thighs and my ankles were nearly the same size. It was a very horrifying experience, but at the same time, it took me to another place where I began to appreciate life in a different way. I began to really enhance my spiritual life. Was really I grew. I began to realize that, okay, so the leg is not working, but the mind is, and the heart is working. And I'm breathing. And there, instead of concentrating on the fact that I wasn't able to go out to do a tour that I had planned on doing with a 9-piece band and a great agency and great management, I began to think about, okay, that was going to be for me. I was going to benefit from that. I was going to make a lot of money. The prices, the amount of money I was going to make was just over the top. In fact, I'd already planned what I was going to do with that money. Hadn't spent it yet, but planned on it. But then after that experience, I began to see that I must tell my story. I've got to help other people. I've got to let them know that I'm still very grateful for life. And with that, I went and I started raising funds for homeless women with children. I started speaking in juvenile centers and going to prisons and just any way I could help, I was there in the community. It really gave me a sense of appreciation for even being in the storm, as they said. You know, I was in that storm, but I begin to tell the storm how big my God is and not how big the storm is. And that really is, that moved me to a place where I started writing songs. My thoughts, my journals were filling up quickly every day. I began to write poetry. I began to paint. And all of these talents came forth during that time. So I can't count it all bad. I'll count it all joy, you know.
Wow. You know, I can tell already, we've only been 9 minutes into this show, and I can tell you right now, this is going to be one of those, this is going to be one of those shows, I can feel it. For those who, you know, again, we've seen you on television, we've seen you in concert, live in concert, we've heard your lovely voice singing for years now, and again, there may be people that are tuning in today that have not heard me interview you before. And people are, you know, kind of curious as to know, well, how did this all begin? You know, when we see people oftentimes, by the time we see people on television, they're polished. You know, they've already paid the dues and they're there. They're on the screen. You know, they're performing to a packed house. But there was a beginning. So if you could, if you don't mind, could you take us back to the beginning for those who don't know the history of Sarah Dash, Queen Sarah Dash. Again, many of us know you from singing in the 70s group LaBelle. Others might know you from even before that, going back to Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. But there's a time even before that. Could you take us back to the beginning? Where did it all begin for Sarah Dash?
It actually all began with my father being a minister, pastor, and it all began when he would do street ministry. There was a time when pastors would go out and sing, and I mean preach on in different communities, and some of them were challenging, you know, communities. They were very challenged. My dad would take me out, and I would go with him. A couple of my other sisters sometimes went. But I had the kind of personality where I wasn't afraid of anything. I was probably precocious, if you might say so. And I would sing the songs, and the people would come by and say, wow, she's got something. And my dad would deliver the message. So it actually started with his street ministry. And from there, you know, one of my teachers, in elementary school, heard me humming all the time, and she said, you know, we're not supposed to have anyone below the fourth grade sing a solo for the Thanksgiving ceremonies, but you have such a great voice, we're going to send a note home to you with your mom and ask her if she minds. And that started there. I sang a song, which I still remember, called With These Hands. And then as I was old enough to stand up with the rest of the other people in the church, youth choirs, I started singing in the church. And on a dare, someone asked me if I knew a certain song, and I said yes, but I can't sing it because I just gotten baptized. Well, anyway, I had my own mind about all of that, and I started a group in high school. And we loved the Dells and we loved the Capris. And so we named ourselves the Del Capris. One of the girls dropped out of our group and I was still singing in the church choir. I went to a church one Sunday and heard this voice that we needed in our group. And that voice happened to be Nona Hendrix. And I asked Nona, would she join our group? And she's like, Sarah, you don't even know this. Many years later, she told me, she said, that was the first and only time I ever sang lead for the choir. And you came in and said, please, we need a voice like yours. So I actually pulled Nona into the group. And there was another young lady. Her mother didn't want her to be a part of the group because she, too, was her parents were in the church. And you know, there were a lot of bad rumors going around, they said, and so she pulled her daughter from the group. So there was Nona and myself. Our manager had, by this time we had auditioned for a manager, and he managed another female group in Philadelphia. And that group was called the Ordettes. And in the Ordettes, they were experiencing the same kind of thing. The girls were leaving, and their left standing was Cindy Birdsong and Patricia Holt, who we all know now as Patti LaBelle. So when all of this happened, the manager, being insightful as he was, put the four of us together, hence Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells. Well, the Bluebells, we started out as the Bluebells, but when we went to join the union, there was another group already in the union with the name the Bluebells. So the record company owner gave Patti the name Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she got that name.
Hmm. Wow.
Our first gig, major gig, was American Bandstand. We had all of the kids in high school running home. They closed the school down in Trenton so that they could see us sing our first song on Bandstand. The best first song we ever sang on Bandstand was I Sold My Heart to the Junkman. From there, the owner of the Apollo saw us on Bandstand, asked us to come. We eventually became the Sweethearts of the Apollo. And
you know, as I'm listening to you, it sounds like success came quickly. You didn't have to, you know, labor for years and years and years and years and years before you got your big break. It sounds like, I mean, with the American Bandstand break and, you know, you got discovered and people fell in love with you rather quickly.
Well, there were some in-between times where we were doing major routine over and over again. There were times when we went to get certain performances and wasn't paid. There were times when we had time. There were times when we didn't work, but we had a manager who kept us in rehearsal all the time. So we were young and we didn't feel, you know, any of that stuff. But there were times when there was no money, and how we actually came to the transformation of Patti LaBelle and Bluebells into LaBelle, we had our manager at that time. Now we were having managerial problems. He was taking risk and taking money and paying, and it was just getting very ugly. We weren't growing. We kept going around and around in circles. We had a great contract with Atlantic Records, but they didn't know what to do with us because we started singing classical songs and like You Never Walk Alone, Danny Boy, and would tear the places down. Artists did not want to go on behind us. I can say that with my chest out today. But in the meantime, we had a career in Europe where we were going to London. We were the first black group to ever appear on UK television over there. The producer fell in love with our work and constantly had us flying back and forth when we were working there. During that time also, we did the Rolling Stones' first American Canadian tour, when they first came here for their American tour. Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells opened for them, which, you know, was a really wonderful experience for us because we got to fly every place. And what we loved about those English groups working with them is that we didn't experience the same kind of prejudice that was being given to a lot of groups because we all got on the same private plane together and flew everywhere together, stayed in the hotels together. There were no problems because of that. And then we were still coming out of the civil rights movement, too, where I guess you could call us a bit of pioneers because we got to finally stay in places that were accepting black acts, you know, black people, rather. So it's quite a story to tell, which brings me to the point of where I am with my project, Sarah One Woman. It's a one-woman project that is a theatrical piece. I have a director by the name of Curtis King. He is the founder and director of the TBAAL Theater in Dallas, Texas, which is the Black Letters in Arts Theater there. And he is my director for this piece. It's a different kind of experience for me to have this theatrical experience where I'm actually part of the writing team, and most of the stories have to come from my experience. But he's been able to pull things for me that I totally forgot, and I don't forget many things, but the things that are important to make this piece work. It will cover the history of my life in the group, also my personal experiences, meeting different people who influenced me, who I patterned my life and womanhood after, and who mostly influenced me as an artist, and who down through the years have been total uplifting people in my life, who encouraged me, who didn't so much encourage me, who tried to stop me. So as a woman, I have all these things that I must talk about. And some people may not want to hear it, but I am speaking from a truthful place, and that's the only place I can be. No lies will be told.
Well, I mean, this is amazing. I mean, I'm loving this history here, and I'd like to know what actually got you to the point of acting. I mean, because you were singing, and you know, very successful singing with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, which morphed into LaBelle, and you had phenomenal success with them. Then you even had success as a solo artist. When did the acting piece come about?
Well, I had studied at HB Studios under Uta Hagen and Herbert Bergdorf. I studied what you call musical comedy with a woman by the name of Ann Gardner. I took tap lessons, and these are the things that I did on my own without group efforts. I did these things all alone. I even studied, went through dance studios, learning movement, learning timing, how to walk on the stage. And I apply that to my performances with the group. I've heard people make comments about the way I moved on stage. Well, you know, I was taught by Uta Hagen that you don't, if someone says to you, act sexy, it doesn't come from an act, it comes from within. It comes from the spirit of knowing and identifying what that is. My first acting performance was done with a television series that I wrote a song for called Watch Your Mouth, and I actually performed with Joe Morton from Scandal. He was the teacher, and I came in as an artist to come back to her alma mater. And just to know that I have that acting experience on tape with Joe Morton is classic. Mm-hmm. And if, for those who don't know who Joe Morton is, he plays the father of Olivia Pope on Scandal.
Okay, wow. Everybody, my special guest is Queen Sarah Dash. If you have a question or you'd like to make a comment and you are online, all you have to do is just dial 347-324-5727. That's 347-324-5727. And if you're already on board, all you have to do is press 1, and then I can bring you on board and you can ask your question. Queen Sarah, let's talk for a moment, even about, if we can go back for a little bit, just even about the transition from Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells into LaBelle, because that, the Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells there, I mean, there was sequin gowns. I mean, that was in the days of, you know, the Supremes and the Marvelettes and the, you know, Vandellas and, you know, all of those.
Yeah.
And then to go from that to Bell, I mean, there was no in between when it came to music. It just seemed like music just changed. You know, it just seems like after the Flower Children and the civil rights movement and all of that, something happened and people started letting their hair down, and then you all burst on the scene, and it was like, wow, when people saw LaBelle. I'm sure that there were people who, some of your contemporaries, that knew you from Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, and now seeing you out there with LaBelle, with the whole visual thing, I mean, feathers and the whole bit. Could you talk about that and just how that transition came about, and was everybody in the group open for it? Because it just happened like suddenly.
As I started to say earlier, we met a producer in London who did the show Ready, Steady, Go, and she took an interest in our talents. And like I said, she had us coming constantly to Europe, you know, London, to do Ready, Steady, Go. Well, I was the one in the group who always sent the thank you notes and took the pictures and made sure anyone who ever did anything special for us, I took it upon myself to send thank you notes and to keep correspondence up with various people. She wrote a letter to us thanking us for doing the show, and in return, I was sending a thank you note with saying, with a frowning face, that we were having some issues and we don't know what to do because management was falling apart. We had some crazy things going on, and we didn't know whether we were going to stay together or not. And she said, well, where are you going to be working? I said, we have some gigs. Some we want and some we don't, but, you know, we need to make money, so we'll do them. She said, well, what are the dates? And so she went through this list with me. She says, okay, we'll do this one, do that one. And one of them included doing the Apollo again. Apollo Theater. Smokey Robinson was the star. There were some other singers on the show. And she said, keep the Apollo in. I'm going to bring some people. I'll be in New York at that time, and I'm going to bring some people with me to see you. And I'm sure they're going to be knocked over just as I am. Well, Darling, Nona, Patty, and Sarah knew what show Vicki Wickham was coming to. And we said, we have got to do this. We were the co-stars of this show. The show that they came to see on that Sunday afternoon, I'll never forget it. It was like the angels came in and swooped the voices beyond where we'd ever gone before. It was very hard for Smokey to come on. The people were still screaming more and more and more. I don't think Smokey spoke to us for years. But being the kind person he is, he did. And he himself mentioned that when we received the R&B Award, Legends Award. But she bought the management of Who, the group, the English group Who. They started making plans right there, right at backstage Apollo. They said, don't do the rest of your gigs. We have a lawyer. We can get you out of them. We want you to go home after this gig and pack. We are taking you to London next week. And we were like, what? I mean, it was so fast. Mm-hmm. We took a keyboard player with us by the name of Gene Casey, and we lived in Chester Square Mews, right around the corner from England's prime minister. It was a year or more of working on songs, stripping us of the three wigs that we had identical, the same shoes, the same, you know, movement, and bringing out individual talents, bringing out individual voices, working as if when Patty sang the lead, Nona and I approached our background voices as if we were answering in lead voices, which took away that little soft sound, and these voices were coming forth. They saw something in us that we didn't see. Now, here comes the part. We are now, because Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells seems dated, we have to do something else. We want to make a difference. And we're coming back to the States, and what are we going to call ourselves? We came back to the States. We were still rehearsing in New York. We had an apartment on West 81st Street. And one night, Patty couldn't take it because she just thought that all of our fans were going to not like us anymore. And she really had a hard time with that change. So we wind up calling the group LaBelle, just simply LaBelle. And the difference in spelling, there is the beauty and the beautiful the beauty is capital L-A, capital B-E-L-L-E, which is Fatty LaBelle's name, the spelling of her name. LaBelle is L-A-B-B-E-L-L-E. So I'm giving you a spelling French lesson as well.
Okay.
we came back. The first place we played when we came back to America, after being in New York for a couple of weeks, the Apollo calls, and Bobby Schiffman, the owner, wants to see what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And he books us, and we come out on the stage singing, "We Won't Be Fooled Again." No one had ever heard it, but the power was there. And then we did Nina Simone's For Women. But while we were in England, we did some stuff that happened to fall on the reunion CD, which was Miss Otis Regrets. We recorded Nina Simone's For Women. So we were coming back with a different sound and a message, because here we are with a new day, a new look, and we're in the middle of a sort of a renaissance in New York City, where people are just loving people of all walks of life, gay, straight, black. I mean, it was a renaissance time. So we happened to make that change at the time the change was needed for acceptance in people.
You know, even as you just mentioned, the being accepted by everybody, and it was clear that you all crossed a lot of boundaries. You took the boundaries and broke them down. I mean, from color boundaries to, you know, sexuality boundaries. I mean, you had, again, like you mentioned, white followers. You had a huge gay following. And it was almost as though LaBelle gave the gay, I guess it was a movement, for lack of a better term, or the gay community, a freedom. I mean, I could just imagine with the costumes and everything, I mean, just, again, like I said, the feathers and everything, that just probably struck a chord and gave the gay community, for lack of a better term, permission to be whoever they felt that they were. And I could even picture, I haven't seen this, but I could just picture Patty calling somebody up on stage, "Come on up here, girl, get it, child." You know, I mean, I could just imagine just the freedom that they felt coming to your concerts dressed in whatever regalia that they may have desired to wear, that it was part of a freedom that you all allowed people to be who and what they wanted to be able to feel free expressing that.
Well, our motive and our motivation was to bridge a gap. That's what we continually told people. Doesn't matter who you are. LaBelle had gay following, but you see, during that time, some gay people weren't allowed to be free. They weren't allowed to be themselves. And some of the songs that Nona wrote, you know, "I Finally Made It Home," "Hello Upstairs," "It Doesn't Matter What You Take, It's What You Make," and the moves you make, you know, just be yourself. Because you finally made it home. You can be who you want to be. Our concerts, you know, there were people who were not evolved and had their own thoughts about, you know, gay people, black people. But I can honestly say that we had people of all races, creed, color, lifestyles in our audience. And we didn't make them feel like they were weird or some kind of freak. Come as you are. You know, we even had prostitutes that follow us, you know, ladies of the night, I should say. And, you know, Lady Marmalade was responsible for, you know, the risque words, as they say, when they found out what that really meant. "Voulez-vous coucher avec moi?" meant, "Will you sleep with me tonight?" You know, it's the story of a woman who met a man in New Orleans, a man who met a woman, I should say, in New Orleans, strutting her stuff on the street. You hear the words?
Mm-hmm.
She said, "Hello, Joe, you want to give it a go and get your ya-ya-da-da here?"
Mm-hmm.
And when he gets back home in his gray flannel suit, you know, trying to do his 9-to-5, he had visions of Lady Marmalade and her fragrance and what she was doing. And, you know, that gave room for, you know, people of all races, because we know that's the oldest profession in the world, yet some people go to jail for it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, even gay people were being locked up for being gay, you know, that whole movement at Stonewall when they decided to fight back, you know. And now we have a movement in America that says we are people too, and we make a difference. And you never knew who was gay or who wasn't. I remember there was an artist who spoke out against the gay race, and her career went down the drain because she didn't know what she was saying. You know, you can't, God is a lover of all people. I don't have a heaven or hell to put anyone in, but I know you could be a bad person being straight, gay, black, white, you know. It doesn't matter. If you're a bad person, you are a bad person. But if you're a lover of truth and freedom and civil rights and the movement, you know, all this came together. There was a man in San Francisco who actually masterminded the million people march, you know. And he was asked to take a back seat because they didn't want that kind of feedback from, you know, America. But you cannot negate the fact that this man made a revolutionary step with King, and it made a difference in us standing up and being counted for. You know, some say that that time in the march was all lost, as we experience today, people being, you know, this, with everyone saying, Black Lives Matter. Yes, Black Lives Matter. And we need to know that all the work that we did in the 60s really did matter. And that's why we're standing up to bad police officers. There are some good officers, but like I said, you go back to the fact that there are bad people no matter where you go. But you know why we remember them? Because there's more good going on than bad. But all the bad experiences you remember, but daily you go through some good things that you never talk about. That's why I said I every day I count my blessings, and every day I really try to make a difference in someone's life by sending out prayers, affirmations, and, you know, just trying to lift people up. Even when I'm having a bad day, I try to really have a moment of giving thanks when I wake up in the morning. And those kind of habits really give you strength. Even when things are bad around you, I said to someone just the other day, they said, well, how are things? I said, things are not good, but I am, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, just we have to be fully aware of the cycle that we're experiencing. And to some it may seem like, oh, the blacks are so selfish and they only think about themselves. No, we don't. You know, they talk about, you know, the Holocaust and all these things, and how the Jewish people were put in ovens, and yet we were brought here to this land. I'm not putting them down now, don't get me wrong, because some of our greatest supporters have been Jewish people, and we all have come together in a melting pot. You know, America is a melting pot, and for those who have an issue with it, you know, that's why they're being pointed out and we see the difference. And now the cameras, the camcorders, all this, we're not letting people get away with things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And music is the line that brings everyone together. You know, black, white kids love rap. I mean, it's just, music is a form of art that is spoken about in the Bible. The tambourine players, the dancers, the singers, they all came before the message, you know. So being an artist and being a singer and having come through all that time, you know, to artists out there who are listening tonight, you are important to life. You are important to a movement that heals people, that brings people back together. Music is a healing force that cannot be denied in our bloodstreams. It could be gospel, rock, folk, pop, and all these different categories, you know, which is how record companies promote you. If they can't identify with you, they don't know what to do with you, which is what was happening when LaBelle came back from New York. They were like, well, who are they? They're wearing all these different clothes. But we set a precedent for how people dress today, how
That's
women
true.
Present themselves. When we came back, we had a female manager, a female lawyer, and we three were businesswomen. We were all partners, and we came together with a force. When Vicky would go out to talk to different record people, I could see the strain in her face because I knew what she was going through. But we knew that we could make a difference in the industry. I mean, we knew.
This is a powerful interview. Again, we have new people that have just tuned in. I can see you up there on the board. If you have a question or you'd like to make a comment, all you have to do is press 1, and I'll bring you on, and you can make your comment to Queen Sarah Dash. Question, how did it feel for you personally? Again, after the Bell came out, hit the scene, and now, again, coming from Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, and, you know, again, let's talk about the dress for a moment, because you were one of the first... And I'd say in the 70s, the visual image that you had was one of extreme sensuality, femininity, but, you know, confidence. You know, if anybody goes back today and looks at even the, you know, old LaBelle tapes, they can see that you are very comfortable with who you are and the way you move. You're very confident with who you are. And how did it feel for you to be recognized in a way that, again, when people saw you, they saw, you know, just sensuality and confidence? Because I don't know if when you were with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, and again, when you had the wigs on and the long gowns, and, you know, to be able to now have a different effect on the crowd. How was that for you personally?
Well, you know, even with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, we came out with sailor suits on. It blew them away. They were like, what? I mean, we were different from the off-start. Them wearing the same dresses, but coming into LaBelle, we can give credit to Larry Legaspi, who came to see us at the bitter end because we were doing residencies at that time. On Monday nights, we would play the Village Gate. We rented the Village Gate, and you knew we could play there. You would see us every night. And the talk around town was like, you got to go come see these three women. They don't dress alike. They wear, I think I had an afro that was big as in America at that time. And, you know, we had Nona had pants on. Patti wore tall boots. And I loved skirts and tops. I loved the fact that I didn't have to have a lot of things on around me. It made the music in my head swoon a little better. I could hear where I was going vocally without the clothes and cumbersome, you know, just being all, you know, with this on and that on. I felt that if we were going to make a statement, each of us had to make an individual dress fashion statement. And that happened. As I said, Patti wore the tights with the high thigh boots. Nona had the 5-inch wedgie heels. And she put rhinestones over her face. Patti sprayed her hair silver. Sometimes it was a different color. She had the floppy hairdos, which just gave her all kinds of freedom when she sang. You weren't accustomed to, when we would sing, and our hair, we wore our own hair, and it would have movement. And the hairdressers would come and say, wow, when you were moving, your hair was just bouncing up and down. But as dressing the way that I did, I introduced a sterling silver bra at the Metropolitan Opera House. I felt that it was sort of, it wasn't new, and in retrospect, I find now it wasn't new. I mean, it was Josephine Baker who had that look, known, the same kind of look known, had the body suits with the rhinestones. And she too was different in a time and an era that she came up. But with the clothes that I wore, I felt if I was going to stand between two women who had strong personalities, as they did, and we each had our own strength, I wanted mine to be a flowing kind of movement, angelic type of movement, but still giving you that sound and working it. It shocked many. Some didn't like it, but I didn't care. What I wore sometimes gave way to some men wanting to think they had the right to touch me. And after a few slaps and then got around that, you don't touch Sarah Dash in an inappropriate way, ever. Mm-hmm. You know, because when I came off that stage, I wore sort of tailored couture clothes. I didn't walk around the streets with the bras and the halter tops on. And yet there was a time when what they're wearing now, the Daisy Duke shorts, we call them hot pants at the time. I wore that on stage at one point. I didn't think of it as sexy. I thought of it as a movement in terms of a look and letting women know that you could dress this way to present your talent and your art. And if someone wanted to have an opinion of you being something less than what you were, or they wanted to say you were a slut or whatever, you know, during that time you didn't use those kind of words toward women, as opposed to today it's gone beyond that. But I felt that I had something to sell, and the premise that we based that on was, you know, if you look at us, then you might hear us, and that's what happened. You know, we used the law of attraction to port and bring in supporters and followers, and the gays were very, you know, they were very strong and instrumental in our development because their community is so strong and they know what art is. 85% of the dollars spent in the industry today is from the gay community. And I grew to respect them. I love them. Some of my friends are what they would call cross dressers. In fact, my housekeeper is a transgender. Mm-hmm. And she's been my housekeeper for nearly 3 years, scaring everyone in my neighborhood, but I dare them to say anything wrong to her. She's an art student, she's a designer, and she and her name is Isis. And yes, you know, and I even have wigs that I don't want. You know, I give them to her, and she's very appreciative of the things that I do for her. And my family grew to love her. We grew up in a family, the Dash family. My father had all kinds of people in our homes because he was a minister. He was counseling. He was feeding the neighborhood. We had all types of people. In fact, there was a gay guy when my mom wanted to, she had to run an errand, she would get him to look after us. She'd come and take care of the kids, and when she'd come back, he'd have our hair. He would be combing in our hair, giving us crazy hairdos. So I've had an interesting life with a Kojic pastor as a father and a mother who was a nurse.
You know, as I listen to you, I'm thinking about how even musically, I think that you all even may have paved the way just even for gay artists. For example, I don't know if you remember a group. There was a group that came out in the 70s called Disco Tex and the Sexolettes. They had a song called Get Dancing.
Yes.
Remember that? Do-da-do-da-do-da-da. You know, they came out. Yes. And then, of course, there was Sylvester who came out. And, you know, yes. I think that you may have had something to do with that, you know, just in terms of paving the way.
Sylvester's on one of my, it sang background with me on one of my songs called Lucky Tonight. Sylvester would take me to his home when I come to San Francisco as a solo artist. We grew very close together. And during the time that I lost my mother, he started getting sick and I was just grieving for my mom and I sort of lost touch with him, but he understood and I never got to see him the last year of his life. Sylvester loved our group. He loved Patty. He he was the first person I saw with a lace front wig, other than people who are in the opera. And that's where he got his wig made, from the person who made the wigs for the opera houses in San Francisco.
Everybody, my special guest again is Queen Sarah Dash. You want to talk to her? All you got to do is press 1. If you're online, dial 347-324-5727. Again, 347-324-5727. Queen Sarah, again, as I listen to you, it's very clear to see that, you know, you are a woman of faith. If you could talk about just the role that faith has had in your career, not just your career, because when we think of career, we think of, you know, the stage, you know, acting, singing, but just even in your personal life, just the role that faith has played in your life. Because oftentimes people, when they think of artists, we put them in this box, the box of their artistry, and forget that they're people, you know, that after you leave the stage, you go home, you know. So if you could talk about just the role that faith has had in your life.
I, being a pastor's child, I was taught the Bible from a very young age, and I was taught to pray. There was a time in during my career where I did not pray. I did not like I was taught to pray. I had a Bible because my mom made sure when I first went on the road at age 15 that she, and let me clarify this too, we had a chaperone and a tutor with our manager, a tutor that came to wherever we were, and we had to work on our, you know, ourselves with our education. But I learned we were going to New Orleans, and this was during the time of recording Nightbirds. There was an electrical storm which shut down the studio that night. So that meant that I had to stay an extra day. I packed my bags and all my suitcases were in the room and I was ready to go, and the studio broke down because I had an early morning flight. So the electrical storm knocked out all the electricity. And I went shopping that morning. Instead of staying in the room, I always like to move around the city to see what's going on. And at the time, there were no cell phones. So I didn't check in with anyone. I didn't even bother to tell our manager, Nolan, or Vicky, or my road manager. He had gone the day before because he had to set some things up for us. And Patty went that same day with him. So I didn't bother to check in. And I knew that Alan Toussaint, who produced that CD for us, I knew the time that he wanted us in the studio. When I called, they said, where are you? And I said, well, I forgot what store I was in. But they said, we need you to get to the studio right away. I'm going, it's only 1:30. You said about 2:30. And I get there, and everyone's looking at me in white face. You know, I mean, they were, the color drained out of their face. There was a flight that I was supposed to take that morning that crashed at Kennedy. Mm. The only person left alive was a 6-month-old baby. There were some crosswinds as the plane was going down to land, and the plane flipped over and caught on fire.
Mm. Wow.
I knew it was time to start again. I knew it was time to say, there's something big going to happen, but you're going to need some prayer. You're going to need to pay attention. You're going to need to play. I started giving my father tithes after that. My faith has brought me through many bad recording contracts, health issues. My faith has brought me through being able to look at people in the eye and hearing the Holy Spirit speak to you and say, don't do that. but you go ahead and you do it anyway. So his grace and mercy, you know, does bring you through. Because that still small inner voice is the voice of God. Whoever you, the listening audience, whoever you may perceive that voice to be, whatever you may perceive it to be, it is the first and pure voice, and I call it God. My faith has let me look at situations since I've been even a solo artist on my own, walking into a place where the promoter didn't promote the show and having to stand and sing in front of 20 people or maybe no people and then have to think about, now how am I going to, this man is going to try to pull something and have the promoter come up to me and say, you know, I didn't know how this was going to work out, but a friend of mine came by and says, here, man, pay the woman. I pray before I go on stage. I have a team dash. We know before Sarah hits the stage, we get in a circle. If it's too busy back in the dressing room, I have a makeup artist by the name of Baynard Giles. He will put his hand on me, and I know what he's doing, and I will drop my head, and we will pray. Faith is the key to life. If you don't believe, and if you don't have the ability to know that everything was going to work out, that's all part of faith. Mm-hmm. We have to walk in faith, even walking in meetings, challenging neighborhoods, challenging people, not knowing, you know, if you're going to get to point A and point B. When you pray before you make a move, and I've heard Oprah Winfrey say the same thing. She takes a moment and she meditates and she prays. And look where it has taken her. And look at all the good things that she does for people. My faith has given me the ability to know that no matter what the valley, what the path, there will be a light there for me to see. Clarity will come if you would just take the moment and say, thank you. Let me hear what I need to do. Mm-hmm. Let me be guided by the force that is greater than me and given honor to it by being a good person. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, now let me tell you, we all have, you know what the Peter spirit is?
Talk to me.
Peter cussed. He didn't curse, he cussed. So we all have a Peter spirit, okay? We come through the Moses of the drunks, you know, Moses stuttering, Noah drank, one of them was a drunk and one of them stuttered. But God can use anybody. You can hear pastors, and you don't have to be a pastor. You could be in recovery of some kind. It is the Spirit of God that gets you there. You get tired of being tired. I'm not saying that was my experience because, you know, the prayer and the anointing that God has placed over me, my parents never had to get me out of jail. They never had to get me out of rehab. You know, I might have been in some crazy love relationships, divorced twice, but I could have stayed and my life could have taken a different turn. You know, I wouldn't be here talking right now, you know. And, you know, and the other another thing is that we have to recognize that there is a benefit to reap what we sow. Mm-hmm. You can't put apples in the ground and expect to get oranges. So you can get caught up in your goals and challenges, and we sometimes forget that, you know, there are other people with different experiences too. And so how I get past it is I continually help people because, you know, it gives us, when you're helping people, it gives us a perspective and it humbles us, you know, and helps us to see with new eyes, you know, and the good that we really truly try to bring. You know, when you're doing the right thing, you know, you become filled with gratitude and that we have enough to give, and that we have enough, and we have to learn to appreciate thee anew, because sometimes we can give and it seems like we're falling down. But, you know, what's a test without a testimony, you know?
Reach.
So, you know, see, and that's the other thing, eliminating poverty in this world, not in this country, but in this world. But we got to start at home. We have to go into the rural places in Alabama, New Jersey. There's some children starving in this city, you know. Having faith that God will show you. I've walked in stores and shopping for food, and I could see that the parents had the kids in the cart, and you know, and something said, give them $20. And I'm going, well, I only have 50, and you give it to them, and then you walk out the door and you get a call for a fabulous engagement, or someone wants to do something for you that you've been trying to get done for years. You know,
mm-hmm.
you know, there, it, my cousin said, you know what she said? She said, out of place, you know, out of grace, and you fall on your face.
Come on. You know what? I'm going to start calling you Reverend Sarah Dash.
Oh, my. Oh, no. I'm just sharing what I learned, what I've been taught. I listen to various speakers, and you know, I listen to Joyce Myers, I listen to T.D. Jakes. There's certain people who are of a spiritual life that I listen to, you know, and when I think about what they're teaching, you know, like I heard someone say, it doesn't take the presence of a storm to interact with God, you know. Because we always are going through a finance, a spiritual, emotional storm. And sometimes those storms are financial. Sometimes those storms are other people, you know. And but the best storm to have is a secret storm. Because, you know, it may not be no comfort there, but the lessons you learn when you come out of that place.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yes, I do. You know.
Yeah,
you know, there's somebody that is listening, a friend of mine, who actually not too long ago had a stroke. And, you know, thank God, it's only through the grace of God that she kept all of her faculties. Her faculties are intact. If you didn't know, if you were talking to her, you would not ever believe that she ever had a stroke. And I'm sure that she could... I mean, she has a powerful testimony within her own right. But as you were just sharing, you know, could you, because again, now the challenge, for lack of a better term, is to walk again, you know, to walk like and to walk right, to walk like you never walked or that you like you never had the stroke. Could you please just share some positive words of encouragement? Not that she's doubting in faith, but I know she's a woman of faith. And I'm sure that she could receive inspiration coming from another woman of faith.
Well, you know, when I was going through the process of learning to walk, had the surgery on my knee, I came to a place where, you know, I heard myself one day saying, oh, you don't understand. But then when I got away from that situation, I said, how can somebody understand me when I don't understand myself? I'm a victim with this leg. I'm not a victim as a person, you know? So you can have the intimidation. You feel the intimidation of others because they go, oh, you're not trying hard enough.
Mm.
Ask God to use you right where you are to strengthen you from your core, you know? Some may be envious of the attention that you get because you are walking with apparatus and people want to help you and stop and open doors for you. Some people can't handle that. But you know what? They're supposed to help you. They're supposed to open doors. You sit every day and visualize yourself being strong, walking. If you got to walk with a limp, That's okay. Just ask the shoemaker to make the heel higher or the sole higher, so that if it makes you feel comfortable not limping, that's what you do. But don't lose sight of who you are, sister. Don't lose your faith. Ask God to strengthen you from a place that others can't see. And when you walk in faith and you know that he is strengthening you there, it's like the miracle takes place and you start to walk with a wave that, and a light comes out of you. That, you know, you'll get the doctors that you need, the doctors they said you couldn't afford. You know, the training, somebody will come and give you something that will help you when you start to help yourself. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean helping yourself to this. You got to, and like my diet, because I was on steroids, I blew up like you would not believe. That 21 inch that I had with LaBelle is not here anymore. But what is here is a strength that I have embraced God. I am humbled by my experience, and I'm willing to go on to see what the end is going to be. And we will see it. We don't know it, but we will see it. So, sister, I tell you, live while you're here in your weak, what you may call your weakness, and see your successful highlights. And it will definitely affect your motor operation in your body. I hope that helped.
Queen Sarah, you always help. I want to give, again, everybody an opportunity. I see you on the board. The lines are lit up. If you have a question or you'd like to make a comment, like to speak to Queen Sarah, please just press 1, and I can bring you on board, and you can make your comment. Two, Queen Sarah. Sister, what's next for Queen Sarah? What are you doing now, and what can our listeners look forward to?
Well, I must say that I'm on the new Keith Richards project called, I just forgot the name of the title. That's the one thing he does mess with you with your mind. Well, anyway, I'm on the new Keith Richards project, singing on a song. Also on that project is Nora and Aaron Neville. I'm going to be working with a producer by the name of Bruce Purse, a song that was written by my friend BJ. I plan to go in the studio to work on that. I'm going to be working with a young man by the name of Rodney Whittenfield. We're going to be working on some children's projects and things, and working on the Dash Family documentary. There are many different people in our family who have come through challenges. My cousin Derek is the first black judge in Santee County in South Carolina. Julie Dash is a filmmaker. Leon Dash is a Pulitzer Prize winner. And, you know, I can go on and on. And we're going to, they don't even know this yet. I'm talking about it, and we haven't even decided on whether it's going to happen, but we will be working on that project. Julie is working on Verda Mae Grosner's life documentary. But back to what Sarah is doing, my birthday falls on August 18th. And Juwanza, I'm going to be 70 years old.
What?
My fans have gotten together. They're giving me a disco birthday party brunch at 54 Below in New York City. It's going to be a brunch on a Sunday. My cousin, some of my friends were like, oh, it's the Lord's Day. Well, let me tell you about the Lord's Day. The Lord is going to be in the house because my cousin Bishop Vance Dash, Pastor Miller, Reverend Kev, and Apostle Daniel Henderson, they're going to all be there to put me in a circle before we start. And we're going to pray, and then we're going to partay. They may not be partying, but we, Melba Moore, my good friend Melba Moore, is going to sing her disco hits. We have the ladies from Chic, The Next Step, Alpha Lucy and Norma Jean. They're going to be performing their latest single. Freddie Jackson called me and said, Sarah, I'm coming to your party. I said, Freddie, are you going to sing? He said, we will see. So we have all of my family. Nona told me she would be there. I don't know if Patty's going to be there yet. I did send, talk to her assistant, sent her a note, and I'll be talking to Patty later on this evening. It's a moment of time that I can't tell you what 70 means to me. See, seven on a spiritual note is seven holes in the face, seven keys in the scale. You know, it's just sevens, the number of the divine will spirit going into numerology, you know. So it's a great time for me right now. Like I said, the Keith Richards Project is hitting September 19th, I believe. I'm working on Sarah One Woman with my wonderful director, Curtis King, with hosting it. I have my projects. I'm on the board. I'm a trustee for the New Jersey Capitol Orchestra here. I'm a governor for the Grammys in the Philadelphia chapter. We have just elected a new president, and she is a radio personality in her own right, and that's Deanna Williams, which a lot of you know from watching her online. We have a great board. We have the board, our chapter consists of lawyers, financial advisors, all involved in music. We have just wonderful people. Our trustees, Helen Bruner, there's also another Sarah who's the secretary there. Our director, Mark Schultz, is a wonderful person. He keeps me laughing. He calls me Feisty Sarah because he says things to me that he knows I will react to in a way that makes him laugh, and I just don't understand it. But I'm doing that. I'm also going to be sitting on the advisory board of human trafficking. So there is a lot, you know, that I'm doing. I still have my school that is in the back of my mind. I'm working on getting funding for the building that I have to, I guess at some point, hopefully in the next 2 years, I'll be able to say, this is the school. You know, I heard someone said, oh, she's always working on something, this school, that's right. Keep talking about what I'm working on, because that only gives me strength in the universe to get it done, you know.
Somebody wants to talk to you. So let me, got a couple of people want to talk to you. The phones are starting to light up. So let me go. I'm going to call out the last four digits of your number, and then I'll bring you on board, okay? 9131, you're on the air with Queen Sarah Dash. Welcome to Juwanza for Life.
Hi, Sarah. This is Tony.
Tony? Which
hey,
Tony?
Tony Spreelia.
Hi, how are you? Tony is calling all the way from Buffalo, New York. Tony is responsible for my photograph art, my archives for my photographs for my one woman show. He has down through the years kept wonderful pictures, and he has shared them with me. Pictures that people have never seen before, which makes it very exciting. So, Tony, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm so glad you're on the radio, Sarah. I'm could tune in and listen to on the phone.
Oh.
I'll be coming to your birthday party.
Oh, great, great.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh,
I wanted
great.
To ask,
go ahead.
I wanted to ask a question about your songwriting.
Okay.
One of my favorite songs is Babies Out of Sight off the first LaBelle album.
Yes.
Is there a personal story behind how you wrote that song?
Well, you know, I wrote that song when I was 13 years old. I really did. I finished it when I was 16. I was going on the road, and I had a little teenage boyfriend, and his mother thought I was probably of a lesser kind of a woman. And I was forbidden to see him when I came back off the road. So that's where Babies Out of Sight comes from.
Oh,
Wow.
Yes.
Sarah, thank you so much for your call, sir. We got another call. Okay, last four digits, 4356. Welcome to Juwanza for Life. You're on the air with Queen Sarah Dash.
Yes. Thank you. This is Renee, and I want to briefly tell you how LaBelle impacted me as a teenager. I'm telling you, it was something about your group that was not a performance, but rather an experience. I'm one of six girls.
Okay.
And I always felt to be the black sheep, and I always felt timid. And it gave me the character boost, and that I needed to know that I'm just as much a part of this group as anybody else, you know? And I was loved and everything else, but you know how you have your own insecurities, especially being 16, 17, 18 years old. You're not certain as to who you are. But LaBelle did something for me that gave me strength of character. I saw strength of talent in the group. The three of you were phenomenal. I didn't see one as better than the other, but I saw the difference and respected it. I learned how to love people the way you all embrace the nation. Like you said earlier, it was just not a certain type of person coming to see you all. Everybody came to see you. Everybody adored you. And in the way you all interacted and embraced people, I learned to do the same. And I know, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the phone, but you all were such an intricate part of my life and my growth and development as to who I was becoming. And sometimes we do need that outside force. We have all the encouragement of family and faith and everything else, but you do need something else to give you another perspective. And you all gave me that. And I love All Girl Band. That was one of my most favorite ones.
That's one of my favorite
over and over.
That's one of my favorite songs, too. And I say to you, you know, the lesson that you learned, it was like you didn't baby that pain of not, you know, being accepted. You just went ahead and just, you know, went through the process of, you know, not being attracted to what you were exposed to, but what God has shown you, you know?
That's exactly right. And
yeah.
And one of six girls and one of 11 children, and we never knew what poor was. I never knew we were poor until we were adults and we looked back at what we didn't have. We always looked at what we had. But I said, sometimes you have to scratch away and make yourself known. And I credit LaBelle with having me stand up and say, I am. Just
oh,
like
I appreciate
the rest of
that.
You all are. And when your outfits, they were not shock and awe. What they were statements. And I said, this is pride, this is confidence, and this is telling the world that, you know, look at us, recognize who we are, you know. I just wanted to say that, and God bless you forever.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your words of confidence coming, or your words, they have really given me confidence to look back with a really a great smile. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Queen Renee. I am so thankful for the time that we've had and spent with Queen Sarah Dash. This is so powerful a show. Again, I want to thank Tony. Thank you so much for calling in, my brother. Again, it's King Tony. And Queen Renee, thank you so much for tuning in and calling in. We really appreciate you. And Queen Sarah, this has been a powerful interview. Again, I thank you so much for the time that you've given us, the encouraging, inspirational words that you've shared and always share. When you come on Juwanza for Life, it's always an honor. I mean, I humbly just thank you because, again, I know that when I'm about to speak with you, that it's going to be a blessed, spiritual, inspiring, enlightening affair. And I just thank God for you, your life, your testimony, and pray that God continues to open doors for you and continue to bless you and keep you healthy and strong. And I'm humbled just to have the opportunity to speak with you again today. Any parting words for our listeners?
Yeah, I would like to say I'm so appreciative of the time and efforts that you continue to give me and support that you give me. And I don't want to do anything that would cause any shame to any artist or my family. I heard the young lady said she's from a family of 11. I'm from the family of 13, and I'm the seventh child. And You know, I appreciate the fact that you, as a media person who continues to call and say, how are you doing? Just checking in. We have those kind of calls. You've brought me back together, like with Lou Gossett and all these people. It's just wonderful to know that we still have supporters like yourself out there supporting artists from our time in our era. And I really want to say thank you all for listening, and come to my birthday party on August 23rd in New York City at 54 Below. It's going to be so much fun. We have some other surprises, which I won't talk about, but they have created a drink in the name of my disco hit called It's Center Man. And Center Man, if you come to the party, you can drink that all for the whole 3.5 hours with no charge. So please come out and support this wonderful, wonderful afternoon that my fans and my friends are giving me. They are really actually doing this for me. Thank you so much, and may God continue to bless you all with this tremendous power.
You know, I just want to say again, I'm just humbled, because it's always a pleasure and an honor for me to speak to somebody who, you know, I grew up watching on television too. You know, I bought the record too, you know. And so when you're young, you're looking at the albums and you're looking at the people on TV. You never know that you'll be speaking to this person one day. And so for me to have, at some point, our paths crossed, and, you know, you've blessed me with your, graced me with your interviews. And again, you know, I view you as my friend. And by the way, speaking of friends, I spoke to one of our mutual friends today, and she said to tell you hello, and that's Michelle Shea. She said to tell you hi.
Yes. Oh, my. Yes. Please, you know, at some point in time, could you ask her if it's okay if you share her information with me? We all lived in the same area in New York, and, you know, time and losing phones, we lose all of our information, so I would love to be in touch with her again.
Not a problem. Done. It's done.
Okay.
Everybody, my special guest today has been the awesome, amazing Queen Sarah Dash again. And this is just one of those shows that I don't even want to end. And you don't either. But Queen Sarah, I'm going to honor your time, because we've actually gone over the time that you've so graciously given me. So I want to thank you again. May God continue to bless you. Everybody, I'm going to leave you with a song by Sarah Dash. It's called Hold On. Okay. And I want you to listen to the it's got a disco feel. You can dance to it. You can work out to it. But whatever you're going through, if you're going through anything, just hold on. He'll be right there.
Yes. Thank you, and good night. I love you all.
Love you back. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Everybody, that was the amazing Queen Sarah Dash. My name is Jawanza. Thank you so much for tuning in. Now, for those of you who didn't know, you can go back to the archives and listen to this interview again and again and again. Share it with those who, you know, weren't on the call, but you know that they would enjoy Sarah. That's Queen Sarah. Again, let them know about the archives. Tell your friends about Jawanza for Life. We come on every Tuesday and Thursday from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. So, again, I bow to you all. Thank you so much for your time. My name is Jawanza. I love you too. Hold on. You'll be right there.